Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Professors In podcast. I am Dr. Karen Kelski, and as always, I'm delighted that you're here with us today. Before we get going, I want to thank our sponsors, and our sponsors are you, the listeners. If you have enjoyed the podcast, please consider becoming a subscribing member. To do that, just find us at bit.ly/ourpod, that's bit.ly/OURPOD, and you will find a way to become a member for $3.99 a month, and that helps keep us on air and pays for our wonderful support staff and editing staff. So thanks very much for doing that. Now, to get started for today's episode, I am absolutely delighted to be hosting a guest, Sarah Jaffe, the author of the new book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. This is music to my ears, as you know. Sarah Jaffe is a Type Media Center fellow and independent journalist covering the politics of power from the workplace to the streets. She's written other books, including Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and The New Republic, and many other publications. And she is also the co-host of her own podcast called Belabored, fantastic name, with Michelle Chen. And she's a columnist at the Progressive and New Labor Forum. You can find more about Sarah at sarahjaffe.com. And that's S-A-R-A-H-J-A-F-F-E. So, Sarah, thank you so much for being willing to come onto the podcast and talk about your work and especially your new book. And, of course, especially for the Professor Is In audience, your chapter on the professional proletariat. Or is it the proletarian professionals? Anyway, Sarah, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, Sarah, before I launch into all of my many questions that I have about your absolutely incredible book, I want to first just start by asking you, what made you write the book, and what's your kind of takeaway, especially for the Professors In audience, which is, of course, disaffected academics?
Yeah. I mean, and who isn't a disaffected academic these days, right?
Right.
I think, for me, I look around and I go like, okay, journalism at some point is like going to get exhausting, but it's not like retreating into academia is a thing I can really plan on doing anymore, because because so many fields are having the same hollowing out, right? Where there's like a few stars at the top who still have the good working conditions and everybody else is scrambling for, a tiny piece of a, vastly shrinking pie.
Yes.
And that's true sort of across the board, right? I can't think of too many fields where that's not happening unless you happen to, work in finance. Mm-hmm. Even there, it's probably happening. I just don't care. I worked in restaurants for quite a long time and in retail. My parents owned a small business. So like I've sort of been in that space for quite a long time, and getting into journalism finally was like, ooh, it's exciting. I've gotten to my dream job. And the conditions are still awful. Uh-huh. I'm still underpaid, overworked, and, being expected to do it all because I love the job and it's exciting and it's my dream. And I've just moved to New York City and I'm paying an arm and a leg for rent and not getting paid enough to cover it and all of those fun things. So, the reality is as I'm in these conditions myself, I'm also a labor reporter and I'm talking to people who are experiencing the same thing in so many different places. And so many of them are getting that thing piled on top of it of like, but don't you love your job? And aren't you grateful to have a job? And aren't you excited to come to work every day?
Right.
And so like, as the conditions of work got worse, people were being expected to like perform the love of it even more.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely parallel to the conditions in the academy where you're supposed to this is actually interesting. I'm curious to know what you think about this related to journalism and some of the other fields you talked about. But I think in the academy, it's supposed to have a kind of quasi-religious calling. that you know, is this ineffable value that you that is priceless, that you cannot put a price tag on. And in fact, if you do put a price tag on it in terms of compensation or benefits or job security, right, you have somehow betrayed the holy mission of the scholarship, of the work itself. And I think that that's really mystifying of the labor in the academy. And do you find that to be the case in a field like journalism or some of the other art, for example? I know you cover quite a number of different fields in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So art certainly is, and in the book, I sort of traced the second half of the book from the stories that we tell about artists and their sort of mystical, magical genius and, you know, the devotion that you're supposed to have to this thing, whether or not you succeed, and yeah, you know, the sort of starving artists trope. It's actually interesting. I gave a talk the other night to the Architecture Lobby, which is an organization of architects.
Oh, wow.
And they were talking about this in architecture, which is not in my book, but seems like one of many fields that could have been in my book. And the way that you're supposed to sort of be devoted to the practice of this thing, even as that just normalizes like horrifically long hours and, you know, low pay or mediocre pay. Yeah, that any sort of mention of your own working conditions is sort of admitting that you're a worker, which you're not supposed to do, because, you know, workers are those people over there. And you see this all the time, right? Like recently, when the workers at Google went public with their union,
right,
a bunch of people are like, oh, but they're not coal miners. They don't need unions. They're not real workers. They're like privileged programmers. And so whatever. And it's like, yeah, but have you seen the top of the Google food chain, right? Like, yeah, they might be making $100,000, $200,000 a year, but like the dudes at the top are billionaires.
Right.
So, you know, and maybe they're not all billionaires, although a lot of people on the boards of, you know, big private universities certainly are. And yeah, it all sort of serves to obscure the fact that, like, at the end of the day, we all still have to work in order to make a living.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You know, your book is, what do I want to say? It's so insightful, and it's also so disheartening in a way. you lay it out so clearly and so candidly, unpretentiously, just this field, that field, you know, the family, domestic work, teaching, retail, nonprofits, art, interns, academia, technology, sports. And I sit here and I work entirely in the field of academia, and I'm railing and raging against the mystification and the gaslighting. But when I put it in the context, like you do, of this much larger mystification, it's so depressing to think how we were all so successfully gaslit for so many decades to believe that somehow we should not attach monetary calculation to our labor in so many different fields. Who did this and why were they so successful?
The short answer to that question is your boss. And, you know, it's interesting, right? Because like it's both a thing that's been around for a long time, right? One of the founding myths of the academy is this sort of like, again, as you said, like quasi-religious devotion to learning. And of course, like early universities were very much intertwined with the church.
That's
so that
true.
Is not all that surprising, right? Mm-hmm. But like the fact that this narrative has sort of only intensified as the labor has gotten, as the working conditions have gotten worse, right? Like that's an interesting thing. And that was sort of the thing that I wanted to get at and sort of poke at with this book, was the way that like the neoliberal turn, and I'm sure, you know, everybody is familiar with talking about like the neoliberalization of the university and all of this stuff. But the way that the neoliberal turn sort of hinges on, you know, what my friend Adam Kotsko talks about as in his wonderful book, Neoliberalism's Demons, which I highly recommend. Mm. And Adam is himself a grumpy academic and is quite grumpy about the working conditions in academia, among other things. But like he points out that what this idea of choice and freedom that is supposedly at the heart of the neoliberal turn, right?
Right.
The neoliberal ideological project is to tell us that everything is about our freedom and our choice. And yeah. this is why we have to put everything in the market, because that is where we find our choices.
Yeah.
And the thing that happens when you tell everybody that everything is their choice is that if you've chosen wrong, what happens to you must be your fault.
Right.
And so this apparatus of choice is actually an apparatus for generating blame. And so that's what happens when you're an adjunct, like the woman that I profile in my chapter on academia, mm-hmm. you're told basically that like, you're just an adjunct because you're not good enough to be a tenured professor.
Right.
And it was really interesting to talk to Kate, because her partner, and she's somebody who went back to school to get a PhD, having had a career, her partner is tenured at the same university where she is an adjunct. And I asked her, how is that for mm-hmm. you? Because that seems like it would be very hard. And she's like, it actually helps underscore the fact that this is not actually my failure, mm-hmm. that this is an accident of timing, that I came into this field thinking I finally figured out what the right thing is for me at the same time when it was just much less likely that anybody was going to get a real job.
Right, right. Interesting. What you're saying about choice is so fascinating. We had mentioned before we started recording that a couple episodes ago, we had Professor Aaron Seck on the podcast, who has a book about what she calls the passion principle. And she, I remember, what you're saying is reminding me, she called it choice washing, as in whitewashing, but choice washing. And it's basically like, if you can call everything an individual choice, then, that absolutely disqualifies a political analysis.
Right.
And exactly. and a recognition of inequality and power structures and so on, and capitalism. And it's really interesting. I often think that we're watching a generational shift where the United States was wealthy enough and in growth mode for a number of decades, for enough mm-hmm. decades that it became our prevailing belief system. That, and of course, I mean, it is Horatio Alger. It is our prevailing belief system anyway. But the economy supported it. That if you could pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that total individualism, and you could succeed. And although that hasn't really been the case since the 1970s, we as individuals making our way through these careers, we have completely failed to actually properly identify that it doesn't work anymore. And we're going into another. How many decades are we past the 1970s? But we are still desperately hanging on to those outdated belief systems. What do you think about that? Like that kind of, it feels like a delay.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, because like one of the things that happened is that like that myth was only ever true basically if you were a white guy, right?
Sure.
And it was not true if you were a person of color. It was largely not true if you were a woman. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing that's happened in all of these fields is that like at the same time as they start to get worse, that's the moment when they finally start to open up to people who aren't middle-class white guys.
Right.
So right now you can get a PhD, if you are a, black immigrant woman from wherever, mm-hmm. But there are fewer jobs anyway.
Yeah.
And so, we get this sort of nastiness of people sort of attacking affirmative action and things like that, right? Because like the reality is like, yeah, there are fewer jobs. You are competing for fewer jobs, but that's not actually the fault of people who are locked out of the system for the last, few hundred years when we're talking about academia, right?
Right.
It's an old system. People who are locked out of it for most of its history are just finally able to sort of scratch their way in the door at the same time as like tuition prices go through the roof and the job pool is shrinking. And now what is it? 70 whatever percent of classes are taught by contingent faculty.
Yeah.
So like, this whole thing that's happened, that this sort of individualized process of choice washing, I love that word. I'm going to use it now. that has happened at the same time as like, the superficial diversification mm-hmm. of these fields.
Interesting.
Right. And that level of blame gets doubled if you are not the white guy, right? Because like, A, like the white guys are resentful that you're there now. B, you're supposed to have been like working your way up and being an example and all of these things. And then you get there and there are no jobs, and you have to not only, you know, fight for a shrinking pool of jobs, but also you have to, you know, find somebody who's not racist enough to actually, you know, give you a chance and hire you. Mm-hmm. And so this like whole system is just designed to be this like terrible pressure cooker. And yet, you know, you see the stories and you hear the stories of like the five people who make good. Mm-hmm. And right. And like, that is the one that everybody points to and says, well, look, you can still do it because so-and-so did it, right. You know, just the way that like, oh, you can be president because Barack Obama was.
Right.
Great. Except there's only one president.
Yeah.
And there's only five tenure track jobs in right. a philosophy department. Mm-hmm. Right. Or whatever it is. I don't know the exact numbers.
No, but like, that's about right.
Yeah. So like, you know, you are hustling through this whole thing, and like, it's really hard to tell people like there's maybe nothing at the other end.
Uh-huh. Don't follow your dreams.
Sucks. Like it's yeah, it's also true of me, right? Like I this morning there was another mass layoff in journalism. Oh. Right, BuzzFeed bought
yes,
HuffPost,
right. and saw that on Twitter.
Fired the entire UK newsroom.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's you know, it's also true of me. Like I'm a freelancer in part because there are no jobs. And I can cobble together a living because I have a fellowship, which means I'm one of an extremely lucky minority of people in this industry who can actually make a living at it. Mm-hmm. And that's awful mm-hmm. to believe, to know, because it's not a belief, it's a fact. And so the thing you asked sort of at the beginning, like what's my takeaway for people? And the biggest takeaway is sort of like what Kate said, it's not your fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not you. It's
right.
not your failing.
Right.
It's this entire system is designed to not only not give you what you want, but also blame you for not getting it.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of a thing I said in response in a Q&A after a talk I gave at a conference for people leaving the academy. And I said, so the important thing is don't personalize a structural failure.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Everybody kind of freaked out. It was like, oh my God. And I was like, wait, I'm going to write that down. It's like, I'm going to have a chat. You know, I'm hoping to get out a second edition of my Professor's In book. And I want to have that be a new chapter. If not, frankly, the framing device for the entire second edition is don't yeah. personalize a structural failure. Like there are, yeah, you made the choice to go into it and you want to try and there are five jobs. So try for the five jobs. Fine. Nobody's stopping you. But,
right.
you know, this is a structural contraction, really a structural collapse right. of
yeah.
academia, the academic economy, and you can try and then just protect yourself and move on and do what you can without being over, you know, without being naive that moving on means you're going to step into a healthy hiring economy because there are none
right,
outside
exactly.
of finance, as you said.
And even there, it's not a healthy hiring economy. Like you're going to have to work 100-hour weeks and you have to have gone to Yale.
yeah.
Sort of like academia,
right.
except different. Actually, it's really interesting. I was years ago, I was on a panel at a conference at Yale, which like there were literally as many students in the room as there were speakers at the conference, but Yale has so much money that they'll just like, you know, truck in speakers from wherever. So I was on this panel about essentially how like progressive students at Yale could convince their friends not to go work in finance. And I was like, I didn't go to Yale. I don't know what this is like. I did not go to like the kind of school where the you know, Wall Street recruiters are beating down your door.
Uh-huh.
That was not an option for me.
Right.
And it was so funny. This one girl was like a Middle East studies major. And she was like, yeah, I've got like, you know, offers of internships at Wall Street banks. I'm like, you're a Middle East studies major. What qualifies you to work in finance?
Oh, and it's,
you know,
Yale.
It's literally Yale. Right. And they were saying such interesting things about the way that like finance and Teach for America both sort of were structured the same way for kids who had like done all the things, jumped through all the hoops to get to Yale, which is like, you know how to take tests and fill out applications. And this thing just sort of like seamlessly moves you through
mm-hmm.
so that you don't get that thing that, you know, people like me got when you got out of college and looked around and went, oh my God, I have no idea how to like be a real person in the world. right. Like I was just like, huh, I'm just going to apply for jobs and see what happens now, I guess.
Yeah.
And yeah, like the way that like there are certain apparatuses designed to sort of move people from one institution of privilege to another. God. And even those are breaking down, right? I saw that was a study the other day that was like, you know, only 50% of Yale humanities PhDs get jobs.
So, oh, like, yeah.
It's even breaking down for Yale.
Oh, no, it's totally breaking down for the Ivy Leagues. I mean, I have, you know, worked over the 10 years I've run the Professors Inn. I've had hundreds of Ivy League clients, and they are not waltzing through and getting job offers by any means. In some ways, my impressionistic, anecdotal observations are that in some ways Ivy League folks are disadvantaged in this economy because they have been led to believe that they have an auto, what did you call it? What did you just call it? It was great. An apparatus. That they have landed in the apparatus and that it will seamlessly transfer them from point A to point B. And the apparatus doesn't work anymore. And a lot of folks who, like me, I went to public, you know, University of Hawaii for my PhD and that kind of thing. And it was really clear that we all had to hustle if we were going to get anywhere. Right. So.
Yeah. And sort of, you know, and I feel this way about sort of prestige media as well, right? That like, I didn't go to Columbia Journalism School, so I sort of don't know the secret passwords. And I used to joke with people that like, do they just like hand you a binder of every editor's email address when you graduate from Columbia? Like, what is it? How do you, you know, because I see people who have like much less experience than me, but went to a fancy school sort of like ascending through the ranks of the prestige publications. And I'm just like, I don't know who to pitch over there. I don't know how to like get somebody's ear, right? Anyway, it's a fascinating thing, right? Because yeah, as you're saying, like even those structures are breaking down. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens there is really interesting. I think a lot about the thing that Paul Mason wrote around the protest movements of 2011. I talk about this a lot in my first book, actually, where he wrote about like from sort of Egypt to Wisconsin, like the people at the center of all these uprisings were the graduates with no future.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was particularly true of the sort of post 2008 generation. But it's also going to be true of the post pandemic generation that, you know, you did all the things and you did them all right. And the thing you were told you would get at the end of doing all the things right just doesn't exist.
Right.
And so like that's actually really explosive in some cases, quite literally, right? Yeah. When you know, the world that has told you to behave a certain way and sacrifice certain things and do XYZ thing, and then you will at the end of it have like a secure life path. Mm-hmm. When that's just gone and you realize that you've been lied to.
Right.
People literally set things on fire in some cases. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm fascinated by like some of the protests we're seeing from students in the last year that there have been like, you know, there was the Columbia tuition strike. There's a bunch of rent striking going on among university students in the UK. Like this understanding happening while they're still undergrads, which I think is great, frankly, because I used to 10 years ago give talks about student debt to undergrads and they would kind of be like separated from it because they weren't paying on it yet. It was still like tuition and sort of in the sky.
Yes.
And then, you know, 2 years after they graduate, when they're no longer in a position to easily organize around it, that was when the student debt would hit.
Yes.
Yeah. And so thinking about like all of this and the way that all of this is collapsing, you know, it's horrible, but it's also like a real opportunity to talk about that across groups of people who are being screwed by it, right? Like those of us who are out here in the workforce that is not the academy, but who have ties to it in some way, students who are currently in it, and the people who graduated from it and are trying precariously to work in it. Like we actually have a lot of interest in common in fixing this thing.
Absolutely. I think that's what's most impactful, if I can use that horrendous word, about your book, because it relativizes academia in the face of what the place academics live in, which is academic exceptionalism, that somehow what we do is absolutely distinctive in the history of humankind and cannot be equated with anything else in the economy. But actually, no, it can be equated with the intern economy and art and teaching and architecture and librarianship, which is another. I just came across the term vocational awe, coined by a librarian whose name I'm actually forgetting right now, so I can't cite it correctly.
Goodness. You know what? I think I have that piece open in a tab right
Are
now.
Are you serious?
I'll find it while you continue saying what
okay,
you said.
Okay, if we don't have her name, I will absolutely put it in the description of this episode so that she can get proper credit.
I do. Fabazi Attar.
That's it. Fabazi Attar.
I just. A-R-H.
Yes. Say that again. Spell that again.
Ettarh.
Yeah, I want to give her all the credit. I just found her on Twitter yesterday, and am already talking to her on Twitter about possibly being on the podcast. But when I read her piece about vocational awe around librarianship and the mystification of everything and all the ways we've just been talking about that it's a higher calling and it cannot be monetized, and thinking about compensation as a betrayal, I thought, wow, you know, that's fantastic. And insightful. But the point being, though, that I was trying to make was that by relativizing the academy, I think it will help break down some of the barriers in the academy that we have for organizing and certainly for unionization. And I know that your book, especially the chapter on the academy, you know, ends on unionization, and and your book as a whole ends on the idea that work is not really meant to be fun. It can be. There can be great gratifying moments, but it's a desire for connection, that it's human connection that is what life is about. Life is not about work. Life is about connection. And that some ways unionizing, connecting with others, realizing we're not alone, not being isolated, that's like going to be the critical first step to combating some of this stuff.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is so sort of, you know, gratifying to see actually is some of those lines being broken down, right? So I know a bunch of folks who teach at Rutgers in various categories, and their unions have been, I haven't actually gotten the chance to go through the details yet, sorry, Todd, about the contract that they just won. But they actually, you know, all of the unions on campus, so from the, you know, tenured professors on down through, you know, administrative staff and facilities staff, all of those unions sort of got together and created a coalition. And one of the things that they did was like the professors at the top who are in the most secure position were saying, like, we'll take a cut so that other people don't lose their jobs.
Wow.
So that we can actually be in like meaningful solidarity with these other people who are at the risk of losing their jobs, of contingent faculty who are at risk of just not being hired back, which is always a thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And so they finally got a deal just recently. And this has been like going on for a year. Mm-hmm. Since the pandemic began, but like, it's really extraordinary to see, because there can be that sort of pulling the ladder up behind you thing.
Right.
Once you do get that coveted tenure track position, you know, you can sort of forget or willfully decide to not help people because, you know, it makes you more secure if you don't have competition or whatever, which is like, it's a terrible way to think, but it's also the entire way that society tells us we should think.
Right, right.
So like, you're not the worst person in the world if you've had that reaction. I have that reaction, and I'm me. I wrote this book, right? And I still I have to fight this all the time.
Right, right.
Because it's so ingrained, right? Like, my dad was very libertarian. And so I grew up with a lot of this, like, your job in life is to distinguish yourself from the masses and all of this. He used to say that one all the time. And, you know, and I'm glad that he pushed me to be whatever I am. He didn't exactly have, you know, Marxist labor journalist on his list of goals for me, but whatever. Mm-hmm. It works. But nonetheless, and so like, to actually say like, oh, what do we do here to actually like improve conditions for everybody? Mm-hmm. That's actually the best way that we're going to improve our own conditions. Yeah. We're not going to improve our own conditions by like scrambling like crabs in a barrel. Mm. We can only improve them. And it's scary and it's a big, messy lift, right? To say we have to fix the whole system.
Right.
But you know, if that seems like too big a lift, just remember that I'm sitting in Brooklyn I'm about 500 yards from the East River. And, you know, in about 10 years, if we don't do something about climate change, this apartment will be underwater. So, you know, right. We kind of have to change the whole system anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to survive.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, sort of looking, you know, sort of moving toward wrapping up here because we're about out of time. I would say that I have observed that the pandemic has pushed people, a lot of people, the pandemic has broken down the gaslighting, has broken down the denial, mm-hmm. I think is what I want to say, has broken through the gaslighting, has broken down the denial more than anything I've seen maybe ever in my life. I don't know if that resonates with you at all.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I wrote a piece last, almost exactly a year ago, because it was for May Day, for the New Republic, that I just said, like, the pandemic has sort of torn away the veil over the coercive nature of work.
Yep.
That we can really see that you know, when we're talking about academia, right, that, like, people are more than happy to tell you to march back into the classroom before you and your students are vaccinated, and they're not going to really worry that much about it. They're going to march your students back into dorms. Mm-hmm. And that's just going to be the thing unless you fight. And, you know, it is not, in fact, too brutal to say that they don't care if we die when, like, literally the lieutenant governor of Texas is basically saying that, like, oh, grandparents are happy to die so we can keep the economy going.
Yep.
Like, the quiet part is now really loud.
Yeah, sure is. So on that note, I hope that this is a catalyst for the kind of change that you're talking about in your book and that I certainly hope to see. Sarah Jaffe, author of Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I have enjoyed this conversation immensely.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
One last note here. This podcast is made possible every week by the exceptional work of our editor and producer, Stephanie Blair. If you happen to need audiovisual work, be sure you go check out baddieblair.com, BaddieBlair.com. And also, I encourage you to check out her phenomenal home decor and apparel designs, and you can check those out at chochochen.com, chochochen.com. As always, Stephanie Blair, we are grateful for your incredible talent. Thank you.